ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Online, it feels like the answer is always yes. Yes to cookies, yes to tracking, yes to data sharing. I'm Ray Johnston, and in Opt Out, I find out what happens when you finally say no. Opt Out, a special series on Download This Show, ABC Radio National. To hear it, search for Download This Show wherever you get your podcasts or hear it on the ABC Listen app.
Hi, this is Life Matters on ABC Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. It's summer, which means you're hearing the best of the best from the year that's been. Today, I'm giving you the wrap-up on all things work-life balance. You'll hear from someone who thinks it's just as important to have a hobby as it is to have a fulfilling job. And by now we know AI is coming for our jobs, but what would it mean for our career trajectory if it takes our internships? Or should we all just be trying to think about how AI can make our working life work better for us? Plus, the town trying to add a public holiday to its roster for their residents' mental health and a healthy tourism boost. But first, how was your trip into work this morning? Did you spend the commute idling in traffic, wondering why you bother with the city, dreaming of the birds, the gum trees, and the house prices of a town an hour or two away? Well, in a submission to the Economic Roundtable the federal government held in August, Westpac laid out the major productivity gains that would come from 1 million Australians moving out of the cities and into the regions. Its reasoning, it would take pressure off our big cities and give an economic boost to those regional centres. So let's talk through this. Could a mass influx of city slickers overwhelm regional towns? What planning and infrastructure would we need to enable this transition? And for you, is now the time to make the jump? If you've already made the move, I'd love to hear from you. What's it been like? What did you need to do to make a move to the region successful for you? Zoe Carney is a teacher in the town of Charlton in Victoria, population 1,000. She's sharing her life in the country with her TikTok followers. Zoe, tell me about Charlton. Importantly, not to be confused with Carlton.
Yeah, that's an important one. Charlton is a little river town. It's about 3 hours north of Victoria, like in Victoria from Melbourne. It's got a really great community here. It is very small, having come from Melbourne. But yeah, like you said, there's 1,000 people, so very small.
That is miniature. You grew up in Melbourne. What was it about Charlton that drew you there?
Well, I'd actually never heard of Charlton. I had to look it up on a map. But I was teaching in Melbourne for a few years and I was doing like quite a long commute and I had really big classes. And I kind of just felt like doing something different. And I had seen that the government offers like incentives to go and teach out in the country. And it had always been something that I kind of wanted to do. Like I was always drawn to it. And then I saw the job advertised in Charlton to teach like health and psychology, which are the subjects that I really love to teach with really small classes. So I just kind of jumped on it.
So you were kind of open to it anyway, and then the incentive was sort of what clinched it for you. How much did you get, if you don't mind me asking?
Yeah, no, that's okay. So the incentive was $50,000 before tax.
Wow.
So it was like a very significant amount. I just bought a little place in Melbourne, so that helped me a lot. And then as part of the job, they help you relocate, which is like all free and they pack up your stuff for you. So it's like really helpful. And I was able to move into teacher accommodation when I first started here, which was also helpful before I found my own place.
How is it different to your life in Melbourne? I mean, I suppose, like, where do you even start, right?
Yeah, it's so different. It's a lot more, like, slow pace for me. So I just do a lot more, like, wholesome things. Like, I go on a lot more walks. I go to the gym. We have, like, a really small gym here at the school, which is really amazing, really, in a small town. Yeah, I just do a lot more, like, wholesome things. Like, I joined the netball club here, which is part of, like, the hockey, football and netball club. So I get really involved in that. And so that's, like, so different to what I was doing in Melbourne, where I'd often like go to restaurants a lot. So it's a lot like slower.
Yeah, it's like a trade-off, right? Like you get a lot of good things, but if going to restaurants is something that you really like doing, like that's hard to do in a small town.
Yeah, it's definitely one of the like negatives, but also I think that like what I see here a lot is people just adapt to it and they're just like, oh, well, that's fine. Cause like when I go down to Melbourne or when I go to Bendigo, I get to go out and then like I really enjoy it and they look forward to it. And you kind of just adapt and you look forward to those things more and like you really appreciate it when you do go and do those things.
Was there anything that really surprised you about moving out there?
I think what surprised me is like how much I actually enjoyed it. I was actually like thinking that I could be really lonely or like isolated and that I'd kind of just have to stick it out to get like, you know, just to have the experience. But I actually like started to love it. And that was a big surprise for me, even like joining the netball club and getting involved in that. That's been like a really positive thing in my life. And I guess just how like friendly people are and how much people have like tried to help me when I've needed it or tried to support me and like welcome me into the community as well.
So you're 30, if you don't mind me adding that on the radio.
Yeah,
do you think that it's the right time in your life to do this? Like, do you think you would have done it in your 20s?
I think it was like a really good time for me because in my 20s, I like spent a little bit of time like traveling overseas and that was something that I like really, really wanted to do. So I feel like maybe a small town would have been like not exciting enough for me in my early 20s. But now I think that I've had those experiences and I kind of wanted to like settle into a job and like get some experience. It just seemed like a really good time for me because now I feel like I really appreciate the things that the town has to offer and also like the teaching job here has to offer. But there's definitely an aspect of like exploration as well. When you move to a small town, everything's exciting. You get to go explore the other towns as well. So yeah, I think it depends on like the person's personality because you could also have a lot of fun if you move in your early 20s as well.
Totally. So this idea of getting 1 million people to move to regional centres, what do you think of this? What kind of advice would you give to the government if they do decide to adopt this policy?
I think like one of the main negatives of moving to like a regional area or a small country town is like the lack of housing options. So the housing is quite affordable, which is a real pro, but it's just like trying to get a rental. There's more like houses for sale, but obviously if you're just coming and you want to trial out a place, it's like a bit of a risk to buy it straight away. And maybe like help finding jobs as well, because obviously in careers like teaching and nursing, there's a lot of jobs in regional and like rural areas, but it's harder to find like other jobs, especially if people are moving in couples and with kids, finding schools and things like that.
Mm. So do you think this is a long-term move to the regions for you?
I'm someone who loves to like explore and have new experiences. So I don't think I would stay in the same town, but I think that I would love to explore like other towns or other areas in Australia. I'm definitely not wanting to go back to the city anytime soon.
Zoe, thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Zoe Carney is Zoe Teaching on TikTok at Zoe Teaching if you want to follow her adventures in the country. Here on Life Matters on Radio National, I'm Tegan Taylor, and we're talking about Westpac's call for a million Australians to move from the cities to the regions by 2032 to give an economic boost to the regions, reduce pressure on the cities, but it's not something we could just do without some planning. So I'd love to know if you've already made the move to a regional centre. What has that been like for you? And what did you need to do to make that move successful for you? Already so many texts on this. One person says, we moved from Brisbane to Toowoomba. Pretty easy move because we still have hospitals, etc., and are only a couple of hours from Brisbane where we go pretty often. We love the less stressful lifestyle and the big sky. Everything is so much easier than living in Brisbane. A different perspective, though, someone says, our town had a rush during the pandemic, mostly retirees, which overwhelmed the struggling health system with their complex health needs and extended the two-speed economy with more homelessness and cost of living, backed by decades of impact from the mineral extraction industry. Don't say where you're from, but I think there's a lot of towns in Australia that would identify with that. Well, Liz Ritchie is the chief executive of the Regional Australia Institute. She's with me now. Liz, we just heard Zoe's story, but you've also made a move to the country.
Yes, good morning. And what a beautiful story Zoe's was. I just love hearing those personal anecdotes about how it's changed her life and how she's so much happier. And we hear them all the time. And I have to say that I personally concur. I am someone who was born and raised in a beautiful country area town called Deniliquin in southern New South Wales.
I know, Danny.
And
yeah.
Good, good. You know, Danny. And, you know, regional lifestyle is part of my identity. It's part of who I am. And it's certainly why I do what I do today. And so essentially, I've had a lifelong dream of ensuring that I could get back to the regions someday, but still have the type of career that I am able to enjoy today, and particularly special career leading the Regional Australia Institute. So, yes, we have made the move to the Bega Valley and a little town called Pambula, which is about 1,000 people as well, actually. And, you know, obviously, I have all the inside knowledge about what makes a town, you know, more livable and what are those factors of livability. So we were very clear to think about what it was that we needed for our family. And, you know, but the biggest drivers were, for me, getting back to a community and ensuring that our daughter and our family can be part of that community and that she can enjoy some of that lifestyle that I had growing up in regional Australia.
Well, you mentioned livability. Someone on the text line says the trouble with regional areas is a lack of healthcare, lack of educational facilities, a lack of infrastructure. When you're looking at livability in a town, what metrics are you using?
Yeah, look, I mean, absolutely, they are important metrics. I mean, we know that education, health, employment are all critical, as is connectivity. So particularly air connectivity was important to me as I travel across the country in my role. And, you know, I guess when we looked at this particular area, education offering is more diverse here, and that was a very important factor for us. We certainly are experiencing the challenges, like everybody else, in relation to health and accessing, local GPs. But we have managed to do that. I think the beauty for me in the work that we do in advocating for regional Australia and actually, you know, ensuring that there's a much stronger understanding and awareness about, what we call this major societal shift to regional Australia, is that, you know, we want to support more people to make this decision to move and to enjoy the benefits of living in regional Australia.
So there is a trend here. Your figures say that 2 in 5 city dwellers want to leave capital cities. Westpac's calling for 1 million people by 2032. If the trends that currently are underway continue, like how many of us are projected to move in that time anyway?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, we thank Westpac for their contribution because they have picked up a piece of work that we launched several years ago called the Regionalisation Ambition, where we set a bold target to see 11 million people living in regional Australia by 2032. If you look at the numbers, we're hovering just under 10 million, and so it's very achievable for us to see an additional million people living in regional Australia. And there are many reasons why this is good for our nation and good for our regions, notwithstanding that we've actually, you know, run the numbers. And we know that when we see the population reach 11 million, we'll also see GDP uplift of almost 14 billion. So there are some financial reasons why this is good for our nation right now when productivity is the new black. But more importantly is that we have this beautiful nation that has been, you know, very much seen as sort of deficit, with a deficit mindset for decades. And it's time for regional Australia to have its place back in the sun. We know what COVID did in terms of supercharging, but what's not well known is that that move was already afoot before COVID. And so people because of the experience of COVID, I think that, you know, they've reassessed their lives. And I think you heard it there in Zoe's commentary, you know, looking at that slower pace of life, she's more connected to the community. It's more wholesome. She's part of a sporting club and she's happier than she's ever been. And this is also borne out in a lot of the research that we put forward in relation to higher levels of well-being, higher levels of happiness. And indeed, some of the latest research coming out of Jobs and Skills Australia is the higher levels of job satisfaction. So even in the face of health disparities and other factors like digital inclusion, where regional Australia doesn't have the same access, we still have these higher levels of well-being. And this can't be ignored because this will certainly make for a more prosperous nation.
So on the text line before, I read the text by this person saying that this influx has really put pressure on their town. We've talked a lot about the individual benefits. What kind of infrastructure and policy settings would be needed to support this migration without overwhelming these centres?
Well, it comes down to planning. We've been calling for a national population and settlement plan. And why this is important is because the reason that we're experiencing what we call growing pains, and particularly in relation to housing and the lack of rental housing in regional Australia, is because we didn't plan for it. We know that population growth significantly outpaced housing approvals and housing construction. And so even before the supercharge of COVID, we were always going to find ourselves in a shortage in relation to housing in regional Australia. And so from a policy setting, you have to actually plan for that. You have to look at the trends that are real, not the forecasts, because the forecasts have never been correct in relation to population movement. That's why we've actually set that 11 million, which is 500,000 more than what the current population forecasts were. So when you think about population planning and you think about the housing that's required to suit it, you can also then start to think about the investment that's needed to match that and the jobs that are also required. So with that population settlement planning, we can target our investment more effectively.
Thank you, Liz Ritchie, Chief Executive of the Regional Australia Institute. Zoe Carney, a teacher who made the move from the city to live in regional Victoria. She is at Zoe Teaching on TikTok if you want to follow her adventures in the country. And if a move to the country is off the cards, maybe you could improve your work-life balance with a hobby or two. I've got just the person to help you with that next. Wake up, get ready, work, chores, sleep, repeat. If this sounds familiar, the daily grind just feels like a never-ending loop. You're exhausted, stretched thin, and probably wondering, where is the joy in all this? But what if the answer to feeling better isn't slowing down? It's actually doing more. Yes, doing more, but not more work. My next guest says she's figured it out, and it might be something you're already doing. I'm talking hobbies. You're about to meet Marina. She committed to 17 hobbies in 1 year in a quest to find balance, energy, and happiness. So tell me, what's your hobby? Why do you love it? How do you make sure you find time to keep it up? Marina Cooley is a marketing professor at Emory University in the US. Marina, 17 hobbies in a year sounds fun, but also a bit exhausting.
It's great for me because I get to call it research.
Yeah, classic academic. Well, talk to me. This is an academic project for you in a sense. Talk to me about what prompted this challenge.
Well, a few things. One, my specialty, as you said, is marketing, and it's specifically content marketing. I study the very algorithms that are so good at keeping us on our phones. And I myself am a working professional. I have young kids, and I'm on my phone a lot, even though maybe I can call it work. And I was looking for a way to find balance like many of us. And I decided to launch a course called Happiness Blueprint and headed to Happy Denmark, which doesn't seem to have the same work-life balance problems that the rest of us have. And the more time that I spent there, the more I realized that Danes indeed do go to work. They do find meaning in their work. And then they walk away from work. And that is because they love the things that they do outside of work. And as an American, that actually felt so novel to me because we pride ourselves in never being off. Mm. So after spending so much time with the Danes and watching how they bike to and from work and then go on a cold plunge and then go on a unique playground with their kids, they were just using so much of their leisure time for relaxation. And I wanted to become like them. And hobbies felt like the most tangible way to try.
There's obviously a lot of cultural and societally, the way the society is set up that allows that. But I do want to talk about the cultural sort of thing first, because one of the things that you discovered was that in Denmark, people don't ask you what you do for work. They ask what you do for a hobby. And that was a real shift for you.
It was, again, coming from the States and especially in a field like academia, where someone not only asks you where you work, but what you study and where you went to school, you're always, you know, immediately reciting all of the reasons that someone should view you as a credible human being. And here in Denmark, it seemed like the shift wasn't on our identities at work, the shift on, but what do you do to be a human? And once I heard that a number of times, and once I went through so many scenarios in which no one had any interest in what I did for work, I became fascinated with, well, what am I missing by asking people the wrong questions?
So you tried 17 hobbies in a year. I have to know what they were. Can you rattle off some of them for me?
Okay, I can. I've tried to memorize this, but here we go. Baking, cold plunging, made collages, did embroidery, golf, hanging wallpaper, horseback riding, jewelry making, mahjong. I did woodworking twice, once to make holiday ornaments and once to make a wooden pasta spoon. Painting, pickleball, pottery, rock climbing, sewing, and tennis.
That's alphabetized. I just realized as you got to the end. Well done.
Yes, that's how I remember it.
wallpaper hanging. How do you decide what's in and what's out in hobby land?
Isn't that the most wonderful question? I think that many of us, including myself before doing this research, viewed hobby as something very official. I actually, in my mind, I think when I heard hobby, imagined a man getting ready for golf and being back 6 hours later. And if something didn't look like that, then it must not be a hobby. But a hobby is actually a much more simple definition. It's just an activity that we choose to do in our leisure time for pleasure. And I met with a few avid DIYers who loved painting their home and hanging wallpaper. And I think that counts.
I am Tegan Taylor. You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. And Marina Cooley is a marketing professor at Emory University. But that's not the most interesting thing about her, because she has hobbies too. And that's why we're talking about hobbies and the way that the Danes view leisure time and how that can really shift our lives. And I'd love to know what your hobbies are. If you've got a favorite hobby that's really cracked life open for you. One person texts saying, I'm that person who buys all the things needed for a hobby and then loses interest in 5 minutes. Have you found that, Marina?
Yes, of course. Everyone has their little hobby closet of dead soldiers. But I think the key is to find a friend and make a night of it instead of going to dinner and drinks again.
Okay. So one of the things that I was thinking about when you were talking about Denmark, and they're going to the playground with their kids and they're cycling to work and that sort of thing. There is so much about the way a country is set up socially, the social safety net, the town planning that allows for an ease in life to fit this in versus other places. You know, the US and Australia sort of sit along a spectrum, I suppose, where it feels harder to do those things. And I wonder if we're just putting up imaginary blockers in front of ourselves, or if there are things that we can be doing differently in how we set our cities up to make this more feasible.
It's a great question. And coming back from Denmark, I almost had reverse culture shock, because as you allude to, everything about Copenhagen and Denmark invites one to partake in leisure. And not every city does this as a first priority. And when I returned, I wanted to see if I could really rebuild my own life in a way that resembled the Danes, even though the system in the States looks nothing like that. And I have to say, I have been so pleasantly surprised by all of the hobby communities that I've encountered. It turns out that a lot of the addiction to work was self-induced by me. And there are all of these Americans that are happily enjoying a work-life balance.
Right. You just weren't one of them.
I just wasn't one of them.
And you're a mum as well, and I think, oh, I can certainly relate to this, is that it feels like there is zero time for you as an individual, but you've managed to carve that out, and that's really helped in your home life.
It has. You know, what I found, and this I think connects really well to content marketing and the research that I do around social media, and that is that most of us, on average, spend 1 hour and 40 minutes on social media a day. That is like watching Legally Blonde every single day for the rest of your life.
What a metric.
And so there's a part of me that just doesn't take the excuse of I don't have time when I'm constantly looking at the data of content consumed. So that is one challenge that I would put out there, is just how much time are we losing to the algorithm. Another thing that I realized was I had been devoting a lot of time to appointments, like a nail appointment, you know, a hair highlights appointment. Maybe I need better eyelashes than I have. And all of that, you know, all of the little spare time pockets I was putting towards meeting an aesthetic ideal. And so that is something I recovered back as well. I have not had a manicure in a long time. And then, of course, you can hobby with your kids. Instead of looking at everything like the work of keeping your kids alive, why not find joys that you can partake in together that are special just for you?
I love that. I went hiking with my daughter on the weekend and it was a total joy. So I'm really picking up what you're putting down there, Marina. So are so Yay. Many people on the text line. Harold says, I love running. It makes me sore and tired, but I'll be sore and tired anyway. At least with running, I can feel good about it. And Julie says, my hobby since my dear dad died in 2022 has been learning the Danish language. It's something I've chosen to do in remembrance of dad, although he has no connection with the Danes in Denmark. I'll be remembering dad while learning Danish for the rest of my life. And she adds, it's a very difficult language. Where do you put learning languages on your hobby, I don't know, roster?
I call it a hobby. It's something that this listener is obviously choosing to do with their leisure time. You can feel the heart behind that. And, you know, you're receiving these messages and they're every one of them is beautiful and meaningful. And after this experiment and after becoming a serial hobbyist myself, these are the stories that I hear every day. And it makes me like people so much more. You really see the beauty of the human race. And it's, you know, as AI really takes over, it's this humanity of learning and of working with our hands that I think is going to keep us grounded.
So part of your research is studying Denmark. You have managed to wangle another trip to do more research on work-life balance there. What are you hoping to find from this second trip?
What I would love to find out, so actually this will be my third trip, and what I would love to get more insight on is how knowledge worker managers are able to motivate employees. So as you mentioned yourself, it's a very different social structure and a very different salary structure. There's not a huge differential in how much money you'll make if you get promoted. So if your employees aren't motivated by a promotion or the fear of losing their job, how do you motivate them to be productive? I think understanding that are lessons that are valuable to the US and other economies as more employees choose to have work-life balance. So that is what I will be asking questions around.
Marina, thank you so much for joining me today. What are you going off to do once we hang up the phone?
Well, I'm at a 14-hour time difference from you, but I do want to share that I played a friendly few rounds of Mahjong today and went for a walk with a girlfriend, and I'm calling that a hobby as well. And I am so appreciative to you for giving hobbies a moment in the spotlight.
Marina Cooley is a marketing professor at Emory University in the States who is committed to doing 17 hobbies in a year. And after this, we're talking AI in the workplace. Is it going to get rid of your job or make it easier?
On ABC Radio National,
the arts aren't just entertainment.
They're part of who we are.
Children's author Andy Griffiths.
Hello.
Springsteen. He walked out and the audience sang the first verse.
Hi, Gary.
Hi, good to be here.
Where are we in space and time?
From novels that spark the imagination
to discovering music that surprises and delights.
Explore the breadth and depth of Australia's cultural landscape
with ABC Radio National.
What were some of the tasks you had to do in your first real-life adult job? Me, as a baby journalist, I was writing pretty short, simple stories about cake decorating competition winners and army cadet camps. My photographer friends were taking photos of products for catalogues. My mates in marketing were writing copy for brochures. It was all pretty menial work, stuff our bosses would never have done, but it helped us learn the basics of our jobs so that when we got to the more important stuff, we were ready for the responsibility. Well, earlier this year, a Netflix series used AI to complete digital effects work. It was done 10 times faster than it would usually take if people were doing the work. And in a moment, you'll hear from someone whose job was taken over by AI, so she pivoted. But I do want to hear from you. Are you using AI in your job? How are you doing it? Or are you a conscientious AI objector? Professor Aaron Quigley is from Data61, the CSIRO's data and digital research arm. Aaron, what was your first professional job?
Professional job? Well, I'd worked in my father's shop in Ireland for a number of years, but I think my first professional role was when I became a teacher of English in Japan. And then I was using digital tools to help me create some of the content that I was using with the students. So I've always been using digital tools throughout my entire career.
You've been putting your money where your mouth is since the beginning. That's good to hear. So with this concern that AI will kill internships and grad roles, is it a fear that's rooted in reality?
At the moment, yeah, we are seeing that there's announcements of reductions in the number of internship opportunities. But I think that's just a cause of industry and businesses thinking about what does it actually mean to have an intern and what does it actually mean to bring in the next generation of workforce. So I think we'll see more roles actually coming up in the future, because to drive these AI systems to actually interact with them and use them, in many cases, it's actually the younger workers who are more adept and are more willing to give it a go and learn and see what's the potential of these tools. So I think maybe at the moment we'll see kind of a bit of a dip, but the entry workforce will start to uptick, because people will need more and more people who are knowledgeable and willing and able to interact and use and drive these very sophisticated AI systems.
That is a more optimistic perspective than I think I expected. It's a different skill set though, isn't it?
Oh yeah, absolutely. But I think back to like every job that I've ever gone into, and then every time I've brought in a new set of interns. Like recently I had an intern that came in from a high school here on the outskirts of Sydney, and I asked him to work for a week using AI tools. I brought him to some of the talks that were going on at the AI Institute in UNSW. I got him to meet with some of the scholars that we know and who we work with. He met with Martin Green and everything. So what we expect of younger people can be just reflective of the knowledge and skills and capabilities they actually have. So I expect more of interns, because I know that they have access to more sophisticated tools and they're using them in their education as well. But I think that's a great opportunity to bring in a more upskilled workforce and actually encouraging them to do more high value work early on, rather than just doing these kind of things that we wish we didn't have to do when we started out.
Yeah, that kind of busy work that you kind of give to junior employees sometimes. Well, it's funny that you sort of talk about this pivot towards developing AI skills, because Leanne Shelton's with me. She worked as a copywriter and then clients started using AI to do what she used to do for them. So she's pivoted. Leanne, welcome to Life Matters.
Thank you. Good to be here, Tegan.
When did you realise there was a problem for you with AI?
It started happening around early 2023. Conversions had started dropping and I started having clients say, oh, don't worry about it, I'll just get ChatGPT to do it. And, you know, I had a copywriting agency and I'm like, we're paid to write website content and articles and suddenly there's this free shiny tool that's just crash-landed in my space. How do I compete with that? And I basically just thought, okay, I could take this time to freak out, but that's not really going to serve me. Or maybe I could use my experience somewhere and go with it.
So what did you end up doing?
So I basically realized that, you know, ChatGPT is all about words and I'm a word person. And too many people were focusing on the prompts, like the initial input, and not enough people were talking about the output, like what do you actually do with the content that AI generates? And so I thought, okay, I'm a copywriter. I've got marketing experience. I know how to make it higher quality. And I put on a webinar, how to use ChatGPT and still sound human, because that just seemed to be a pain point for a lot of people, how robotic it sounded. And I kind of taught myself over a month of how you can actually train this tool to work with you and then pump out quality content. And so that's how it kind of started, but it's kind of evolved a bit from there.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor talking to Leanne Shelton, who was a copywriter, still is kind of, but now harnessing the power of AI to still kind of retain value in the market, and Professor Aaron Quigley from CSIRO's Data 61. So Aaron, listening to Leanne, she could adapt. Some people can't. Like, what do you do if you're in one of these roles that doesn't seem to be adaptable, or are you just not being creative enough?
I think reach out to other people who actually have these experiences like Leanne did. We're not alone anymore. There's huge numbers of networks actually available. There's all kinds of training courses online. There's ways to actually find other people. So finding mentors, I think, is going to be very important in the future. And not just a single mentor, but actually having like some domain-specific and some career-specific mentors across two or three different areas, and then getting advice from them and getting introductions to people who are a little bit further advanced in their career than you. It's very heartening to hear what Leanne did, like taking the tools, learning, embracing them, and actually adding value beyond. Because I do really feel that we're talking about using a new tool, that we should be embracing this. Lots of tools have come along and people are worried that it'll displace jobs, but what it ends up doing is creating new jobs, creating new opportunities, because we just expand human knowledge, we expand the capabilities of individuals, and it opens up and kind of democratizes a lot of these tools. I mean, you were talking about Netflix earlier, and the fact that like small studios in remote locations can get access to what would be prohibitively expensive digital effects, and they can actually now show their creativity and their capabilities in small regional areas in places that, you know, Hollywood would never necessarily look to for skills and talent and content. It does open up a huge world of potential to give everyone's creative abilities. And then, of course, you know, the studios that actually do have access to the kind of the next generation technologies, they can still be at the cutting edge. But for everybody else, you do have, it does expand the potential and widens out what we can do as humans. Mm. And it does democratize a lot of access to these kind of skills and capabilities.
Leanne, I can hear you going, yes, in the background there. What do you sort of hope people understand about this landscape?
Yeah, so definitely expand on that. I really believe in using AI to amplify your experience and expertise, just like what I've done. You know, there's so many other roles that, you know, things like we still have bank tellers, even though I've had online banking. We still have QuickBooks and Xero, even though, you know, we have accountants and bookkeepers, even though we have those software, and graphic designers, even though we have Canva. And so the thing is that we need to realize that there's still always going to be a place for humans. What my concern is where people get lazy with AI and go, oh, look, just ask ChatGPT, just, you know, get them to do this for you. And what I call it is like, it's a bit of a productivity trap. Like, you get caught up in how good it is in the moment, how much time it's saving you, but not thinking about how it lands. Mm. And so what it needs to come back to is this remembering, all right, where can actually enhance me and what I know, not replace my knowledge. And I don't want people who know nothing about a topic and just getting AI do it for them. We need to be using it. So the junior workers, you know what you know is fresh out of university, and you know how to use tools like you're born with a phone in your hand. You can. They're more likely to embrace and think differently to older people as well. So there's definitely opportunities for everyone. It's just like embracing that and just remembering that the humans must always stay in control. Like, I really believe in a human first approach and not, the tools taking over.
There's a wonderful text on the text line from Mark. Mark says, using AI for introductory and junior work is inappropriate. I've seen a similar thing in the trades and manual work. It pays off in the skills and competence to use hand tools first, then the power tools. They're more effective if they have competence with the hand tools. Likewise, the computer assist. There are also reports that the human programmers are now doing even more. The AI-generated code needs review, and that takes more than doing from scratch. Aaron, what's sort of your parting words to people who are kind of going, how do I navigate this landscape? How do I develop the right skills or help the junior people in my life develop these skills?
I would definitely echo what we just heard, that it's the human voice that we want to accentuate and amplify. And we want to make sure that whatever we're doing is going to be very authentic. The worst thing you can actually see is when somebody is using a system and they're literally just passing it through. They don't actually have the capabilities to actually understand that it's an augmentation. It's an expression of them that they're basically putting forth into the world. So if it's not authentic, and if it's not actually amplifying the human voice, then I think that's a risk for all of us. And the way to do that is to encourage younger people to actually develop their own voice, and then to use AI to just amplify that, so that they actually have the capabilities to look at what is being produced. All those software engineers you're talking about, those hardware engineers, all those developers, all those designers, all those content producers, they need to look at what's produced and use deep human intelligence and deep expertise to actually know that this is actually amplifying their voice and isn't just some hallucination or some fantasy that's actually being produced. So there's still a huge amount of human knowledge that actually is needed to guide what the AI can actually do for us.
We're not redundant yet. Well, thank you both for joining me today. Professor Aaron Quigley is from Data61, the CSIRO's data and digital research arm. And Leanne Shelton is the founder of AI training agency Human Edge. And if you are already dreaming of the weekend, even though it's only Wednesday, you'll want to hear about the town who wants to create another public holiday for their region. Australians have a bit of a knack for stretching out a weekend, whether it's with a public holiday or the occasional cheeky sticky. But before you call it lazy, consider this. Australia ranks among the most burnt out countries in the world. Enter Mudgee, a regional New South Wales town with a bold idea, a brand new public holiday they want to call Mudgee Monday. Earlier this year, the local tourism board launched a petition for the extra day off, not just to boost local travel, but to encourage rest, reconnection, and a rethink of how we think about time off and mental well-being. So tell me, what would an extra public holiday do for you? Do you think this extra long weekend would prevent burnout or just delay it? Or do you think throwing another long weekend out there would just cost us more than it gives us? Well, Emma Greeny is the Director of Policy and Advocacy for Mental Health Australia, and Bo Cassis is a spokesperson for Mudgee Monday, the Chief Executive for Mudgee Regional Tourism. Bo, you've launched this petition. What are you proposing?
Good morning. Look, this campaign has been designed to really put the Mudgee region into the broader news agenda. And we know that there's such a vibrant conversation happening around burnout, mental health and work-life balance. We know when travel is done well, it's a wellness strategy in its own right. So the whole purpose for us is to get that conversation out there, have Aussies really consider how travel's meant to be and the wellness benefits that are aligned with that, to slow down and take an extra day and extend their weekend anytime throughout the year, because we know that'll have a lot of benefit for them.
But people already take mental health days. What difference would one more public holiday actually make?
Yeah, we thought that too. And what we really based that decision on and the thought behind it was that over, you know, 60% of Aussies believe that that extra long weekend will reduce the stress and burnout for them. But what was most interesting is that 50% of Aussies have admitted to calling in sick for an extra day off or to extend their weekend travel plans. So it's a movement that's already happening. What we want to encourage is that people call in well before they're required to call in sick. Make it a proactive decision that's planned out and really thought out to be part of that wellness strategy.
So Emma, you're with Mental Health Australia. What do we know about burnout numbers in Australia at the moment?
Yeah, hi Tegan. Unfortunately, we do know that the rate we're seeing of burnout, particularly in workers in what gets called the knowledge economy, which sounds pretty fancy, but just really means people who use thinking as the core part of their work and are often desk-based. Up to 62% of workers in a 2022 study reported experiencing burnout, and that was actually the highest among the countries that were surveyed at that point in time, which included Canada, US, Brazil, France, Germany, UK, several others. So that's alarming to start with. Now, of course, 2022, we can all recall, was a trying time for us. And we were working our way through the tail end of a pandemic. But I would argue that some of the things we've seen since then, including a cost of living crisis piled up on top of that pandemic response, have probably just led to people juggling even more in their day-to-day life, potentially risking higher rates of burnout again. We don't have a 2024 study, but there's a 2023 study that, again, looked at desk-based and frontline workers in Australia and several other countries. At that point, we were still the second highest rate of burnout, significantly above the average rate.
Is using time off, like sick day or a bit of annual leave here and there to make a long weekend, does that help us?
It certainly doesn't hurt to be able to spend some time to rest, but I would argue that there are lots of things that have to be done to both prevent and ameliorate the early signs of burnout. Rest isn't entirely responsible as one of them, but another is also the way that workforces are set up. And so employers have a certain responsibility in how they're caring for their employees, and the issues like workload and bullying, harassment, the culture of workplaces is significantly important. Also, it's really important to consider whether people are also juggling caring responsibilities. So in 2023, Carers Australia conducted a study of unpaid caregivers. 94% of those surveyed reported often feeling physically or mentally exhausted due to caregiving responsibilities. So if we're thinking of parents or we're thinking of people caring for other loved ones, including elderly members of the family, that potential for burnout probably increases. And the need for rest is certainly an aspect of how we would respond to that concern.
You're listening to Life Matters here on Radio National. I'm Tegan Taylor. I'm talking to Beau Cassis from Mudgee Region Tourism about how they're trying to get Mudgee Mondays going, an extra public holiday there, and Emma Greeny from Mental Health Australia. And Robin says, what about spreading public holidays out evenly over the year? Maybe add a couple more if need be. Louise in Cairns says, I recently learned a great trick. In the dry period of public holidays, take your annual leave days on random Mondays and Fridays instead of always taking chunks of leave. It's been working well. Another text says, Canberra, it's the place to live. They get all the usual public holidays plus Canberra Day and Reconciliation Day. Different states have a different number of public holidays. Because, yeah, Bo, New South Wales and WA only get 11 public holidays a year. Tassie gets 10. The other states get like 13. Do we need national standardisation, do you think?
There is suggested evidence that Aussies are looking for that. Just over 50% of Aussies want to standardise it. But I think that's, you know, over to the states and the laws that come from it. What we're trying to encourage is that we just want to even the stakes here. If it's good for one, it should be good for all. And by evening those numbers and encouraging all Aussies to take rest before wreckage is a good step forward.
Someone on the text line, Beau, says, Mudgee Monday every week. Let's be ambitious. 4-day
work
week.
That's the point.
And it would. And and universal basic income would improve our society immeasurably. More public holidays, we need at least two more, preferably three more. Quite silly, Jacqueline says, this talk of the economy will suffer. The economy is for us, not the other way around. Yeah, Bo, I don't, I know that you're with a tourism board. I don't want to put too much weight on your shoulders, but what about the economy? What about small businesses who are absorbing these costs when we're all kind of nicking off and having a lovely long weekend?
Yeah, it's a difficult conversation, and you know, there's always some that benefit and some that are affected or impacted. What we know for the Mudgee region is a third of every dollar spent in our region comes from a visitor. And when we look at a long weekend, that near doubles. So it's the visitor that we're welcoming that literally keeps small businesses in our region afloat and providing for their families and keeping our regional economies growing. We need to encourage visitors to slow their trips down, come back, and to enjoy the benefits, not just to their well-being, but knowing that they are supporting local business to reduce those financial pressures and burdens regionally. We do, at the same hand, though, need to really consider the industries and the people working within the tourism or hospitality industry that are then tasked with working on public holidays and ensure we find a solution for them to have a well-deserved break as well.
Yeah, and it feels like the numbers that you're saying there are probably a bit of a case study for other tourism spots around Australia.
Exactly.
Emma, a text that I'd love to put to you. Someone says, if you need to call in sick to extend the weekend, your mental health is probably in jeopardy, i.e. you actually are sick.
I mean, certainly. The reality is being sick doesn't always look like having the flu. And we need to consider that Australians, you know, over history fought really hard for the rights that we have in this country, including for sick leave. And the way that people need to take that time to restore their own well-being and be present and productive at work might look different today than it did in, you know, 1950. At the end of the day, we've very much moved towards more of a knowledge economy where we're having people use their brains as their livelihood. And, you know, that does mean that that will be the most exhausted part of them, and that might be the part that needs rest and recuperation. And so I actually would not at all be concerned by people saying that they needed to take mental health days. I think that's a really great trajectory for us to be on, to break down the stigma regarding mental health and mental well-being concerns and let people use the leave they're entitled to for what is in their best interest. And so I think it's also a great call out for workplaces. If people are confident to tell their boss, their employer, that they need a day of mental health leave, I think that's also a great opportunity for that workplace to start having a conversation on that worker's return. Are there other supports they might need in the workplace? Is it a particularly challenging period of work? Is the workload too high? Are there other supports that could be offered? And I think it's that opportunity for a two-way conversation to ensure that A, that person feels well supported and engaged in the workforce, but B, that workplace is going to retain a great worker. I think that's the other thing that needs to be considered.
Such good insights. Thank you both for joining me. Emma Greeny is the Director of Policy and Advocacy for Mental Health Australia. Bo Cassis is a spokesperson for Mudgee Monday and the Chief Executive for Mudgee Region Tourism. And earlier in the program, you heard about calls for 1 million Aussies to move to the regions. Thank you so much for sharing your stories. This texter says, our town had a rush during the pandemic, mostly retirees, which overwhelmed the struggling health system with their complex health needs and extended the two-speed economy with more homelessness and cost of living backed by decades of impact from the mineral extraction industry. Another says, I live an hour and a half from Sydney. Downsides, councils can't cope with the massive influx. The roads need fixing. The roads through town can't cope. The wildlife habitat destruction is significant for new buildings. Getting tradespeople is difficult. House prices have risen. The trains are slow and there are not enough, and the freeway traffic has increased. Children eventually have to move away. And another says, we moved from Brisbane to Toowoomba. Pretty easy move because we still have hospitals, etc., and are only a couple of hours from Brisbane, where we go pretty often. We love the less stressful lifestyle and the big sky. Everything is so much easier than living in Brisbane. So if you're thinking about making the move away from the city, here's what drew teacher Zoe Carney to a town called Charlton in regional Victoria.
Well, I'd actually never heard of Charlton. I had to look it up on a map. But I was teaching in Melbourne for a few years and I was doing like quite a long commute and I had really big classes. And I kind of just felt like doing something different. And I had seen that the government offers like incentives to go and teach out in the country. And it had always been something that I kind of wanted to do. Like I was always drawn to it. And then I saw the job advertised in Charlton to teach like health and psychology, which are the subjects that I really love to teach with really small classes. So I just kind of jumped on it.
Well, that's it for today on Life Matters. To listen back on any of our segments, you just search Life Matters in your ABC Listen app. Hit follow while you're there so you never miss an episode. And we've got more stories that you loved from this year on the show tomorrow with the best of our parenting yarns. Thanks for listening. I'll catch you again then.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.